The information presented on this program is not intended to take the place of your personal physician's advice and is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Discuss this information with your own physician or healthcare provider to determine what is right for you. Welcome to Sanitas at sanitasradio.com, because your health and longevity should not be classified information. And now, here's your host, Mel Fabregas.
Greetings to everyone around the world, and a warm welcome to another edition of Sanitas at sanitasradio.com. I'm your host, Mel Fabregas, and I sincerely thank you for joining me once again. And to listen to tonight's full interview and all of our material, all you need to do is subscribe by going to sanitasradio.com. And if you would like to write to me, you would like to be a guest on this radio program, or would like to submit a guest suggestion, I'd love to hear from you. Just go to our website and click on the contact link. And like us on Facebook. Is coffee good for you? Will sausages kill you? Should you avoid sugar, fat, salt, or all three? Have you booked your smear test yet? Considering bariatric surgery? Are you taking statins like a good boy or girl? Or should you just ignore this relentless bombardment of medical advice? And remember that no one gets out of life alive. Tonight's special guest takes a scalpel to the world of medical research and dissects it for your inspection. He will reveal the tricks that are played to make minute risk look enormous. How the drug trials are hyped, the data manipulated, the endless games that are played to scare us into doing what, in many cases, makes the most money. Listen to tonight's interview, and you will know what to believe and what to ignore. You'll have a much greater understanding of the world of medical research. Tonight's special guest is Dr. Malcolm Kendrick, who graduated from medical school in Aberdeen and trained as a general practitioner in Scotland. After 10 years, he split his time between general practice and education. The Great Cholesterol Con was the book that firmly placed Dr. Kendrick on the world stage of the diet cholesterol heart hypothesis, and his army of followers are eagerly awaiting his next bout of wit and wisdom. His new book, which is the focus of tonight's interview, is titled Doctoring Data: How to Sort Out Medical Advice from Medical Nonsense, and it's now available for sale. His website is drmalcolmkendrick.org, which is also linked to ours. And directly from Cheshire, Macclesfield, UK, I would like to welcome Dr. Malcolm Kendrick. Hello, Dr. Kendrick, and welcome to Sanitas. How are you?
Yes, I'm very well, thank you. So we're ahead of you, so it's late in the evening for me. But
very ahead of us. First of all, I loved, as I said before we started, I loved the way in which you inject humor in such a serious topic. But as you say, no matter how healthy you are, we're not coming out of here alive. What made you, with these two books, the Great Cholesterol Con and now Doctoring Data, you are a medical practitioner, and it seems very unlikely that somebody like you could stand up to the establishment. Tell me what motivated you to do this.
Well, a lot of people have asked me this, and I would never have put myself down as a Don Quixote chasing after the windmills kind of guy and trying to
exactly
turn things upside down. But I suppose because I'm Scottish, at the time I grew up, went through medical school, heart disease was the number one, well, whether it's true or not, it was supposed to be that heart disease in Scotland was the highest in the world. So it was quite an interest, just why is this, why Scotland, why have we got this heart disease? At the time, everyone was saying the same things as they are now. Basically, it's because the Scots eat a terrible diet, they eat deep-fried Mars bars, everything, they don't eat any vegetables, and their cholesterol levels are high, and that's why they get heart disease, because their cholesterol levels are very high. I had no reason to disbelieve this. Well, why would you? You're taught stuff and you digest stuff. But I'm not quite sure why, but I started looking at it and I thought, this just isn't making sense. First of all, the Scots don't have a particularly bad diet, although everybody says that they do. And anyone who's had one deep fried Mars bar will only ever have one, because you'll never eat another one. So a lot of these things are, like many things, there's a lot of things are myth. Everyone comes to believe that they're the case. But when you actually start looking at it, you think, you know what? This isn't adding up. This just isn't adding up for me.
And it's become very clear to me after doing this for not as many years as you have doing what you do, but in studying all of this, that we can't enjoy life's simple pleasures anymore. You know, lying in the sun. Oh, do not do that. You're going to get skin cancer, or a bacon sandwich. You're going to get, we're going to have a heart attack. Cholesterol levels will go up. It seems that everything that used to be pleasurable, now it's not. Is this true, or is this just a way to keep us in fear?
You don't want to sound like a mad conspiracy theorist. But there doesn't. I sometimes think to myself, and I think there's a lot in it, that over, well, since mankind's been around, there have always been people who wanted to be in charge. And of course, one of the easiest ways to be in charge is to say, I know how to make things go well. I know how to keep you healthy. I know how to make you, to reduce the fear of nasty things happening to you. So there's always a sense of some people saying, right, well, I know what to do, and I'm going to tell you what to do, and this is what you're going to do. And for reasons that I suppose are deeply embedded in our psychology, it seems to be that it's quite easy to get people to say, well, if you're enjoying it, it must be bad for you, because things that are enjoyable are just bad. And I suppose you can go back in sort of man's history and see that people have proposed that idea for thousands of years. And so sort of pain and suffering and, doing nasty things to yourself has seemed to have some sort of reward, whereas sort of lounging around, lying in the sun, eating a nice cream cake and having a nice drink, it almost seems to affront people to say, you know what, that's actually quite good for you. That'll make you healthier and live longer. There's a kind of intake of breath. How can you say that? It must be true that doing things that are pleasant must carry a cost, and doing things that are apparently self-denying and self-sacrificing are good for us. And I do think quite a lot of that attitude has spilled over into medicine. And I don't want to go into that in too deep, otherwise you can find yourself in some quite muddy waters. But I think there is an element of that is true. So, lying in the sun and enjoying yourself, getting a nice suntan, is almost an affront to people going, that must be causing you damage in some way. They can't show that it causes you damage in some way. And I think there's some very strong evidence that lying in the sun and getting vitamin D and nitric oxide is increased in your skin. And all these things are actually amazingly good for you. I don't know if you're aware of a study from Denmark, came out 3 or 4 months ago. And what it demonstrated was that people who had very little or no sun exposure compared to people who had a lot of sun exposure had significantly more risk of various cancers, and the life expectancy was reduced to the extent that avoiding the sun could be said to be as unhealthy for you as smoking. That's what this study showed.
So it's better to be out in the sun because it reduces cancer, but then we're told, yep, we're going to get skin cancer, but we'll discuss that later. I have a point to discuss later, but we're told that 85% of the adult population in the Western world has high cholesterol. Does that mean that 80% of people are at high risk of heart disease, or are these statistics stretching the concept of quote-unquote average to the breaking point and well beyond?
Well, I think yes. I mean, I think it has become ridiculous. If I go back, when I first graduated, a high cholesterol level was considered, it was called familial hypercholesterolemia, but this definition changes and mutates around, so you have to be, it's a very difficult thing to catch hold of. But anyway, a level above which was thought to be unhealthy was about 7.5 in Europe. Is we use millimoles per liter as our measurement, and you use milligrams per deciliter. And unfortunately, the calculation is multiplied by 38.57 or something of that order. But anyway, in America, 200 milligrams per deciliter is considered normal. That's approximately 5 millimoles per liter, if that makes sense. It's not quite, it's actually 200 is 5.2. But so 7.5 would be about 350. So when I first graduated, 350-ish was considered high. and nobody was much bothered if it was any lower than that. And then over the years, it's come down and down and down and down and down. And there's very little evidence for any of this. I would use an example that in Switzerland, for example, the average cholesterol level, and this is total cholesterol level, because as you know yourself, cholesterol has split into a myriad of different subsections and fractions and particles and God knows what all such. It has become impossible to understand what anyone's talking about. But if you talk about total cholesterol, which is a reasonable kind of figure, the average in Switzerland is 6.4, which is about just under 300 milligrams per deciliter. I'm doing these calculations in my head, so if someone phones in and says I'm talking rubbish, then but it's approximately right. And the Swiss have the second lowest rate of heart disease in Europe, and it would be about a third of what it is in the US. So you have to look at, there's an entire country. And in fact, someone did an analysis of all the countries in the world and their cholesterol levels, although some countries don't measure cholesterol levels, so you don't really know what it is on average. But essentially, there's a very strong negative relationship. In short, the higher the average cholesterol level is in a country, the lower the rate of heart disease in that country on average. Obviously, there's outliers here, there, and everywhere. So if you look at it from an epidemiological basis, it's wrong. And if you look at it from all sorts of research basis, it's just wrong. How anyone could sustain it in the face of such, I mean, if we look, say, at France, for example, and we're talking about the French, they have the highest saturated fat intake in Europe. 15.5% of calories in France are saturated fat. They have a cholesterol level that is about the same as it is in Britain and America. It's around about 5.4 or 5.5 on average. And their rate of heart disease is one quarter of that of the United Kingdom. It's always been very low. And that would be UK and US have about the same rates of heart disease now. Not exactly, but just about. So you start looking at around the world and you just find there's no correlation, at all, between the level of cholesterol in a population and the rate of heart disease in that population. And in fact, such correlation as there is the wrong way around.
And by the way, we hardly hear of those studies in the United States for, I think, obvious reasons. I think this is a multi-billion dollar industry. I'd like to know what makes things tick. What originated all of this? I mean, who came up with the idea of measuring cholesterol in order to create this huge industry?
Well, it kind of grew over time. The first person to propose cholesterol was associated with heart disease was Rudolf von Virchow in 1852. But if you go, there wasn't much happened for about another 50 years or so. And Tishkov, a Russian researcher, fed cholesterol to, I think it was rabbits, and then found that they developed what looked like atherosclerosis. But it wasn't really until after the Second World War, and this was in the US, because in the US had the first, if you like, epidemic of heart disease, ahead of all other countries in every way, America, hooray! And for reasons that I'm not going to go into here, but suddenly people looked around after the Second World War and it seemed that almost every middle-aged man was dropping dead of a heart attack, or at least the rate was very, very high. So there was a great kind of panic, if you like. Well, there actually was a panic. Of what is causing this? What's going on? Why are so many people dying? It was happening in other countries. In the UK, the rate was going up, and in other countries, it was going up in the sort of 50s and 60s. It's a bit difficult to know what the rate was for sure, because people used to categorize it in different ways, but it definitely was really quite a major problem in the starting. It didn't really start in the 1940s, but that's when people became aware of it. So people started saying, well, what's causing it? What's causing it? And there were various ideas kicking around. But one man in particular said, I know what causes it. What causes it is people eat too much fat. It raises their cholesterol levels and then they die of heart disease. And that man was Ansel Keys, as you probably know. He then carried out studies around the world where a lot of people believe he basically falsified his data left, right, and center. There are people who say his data was wonderful, but he definitely cherry-picked the countries he looked at. He left out France, for example. I wonder why. And other countries like that where there were a high consumption of saturated fat and low rates of heart disease, and then tended to focus only on countries that appeared to support what he was saying. At the same time, in America, in Framingham, near to Boston, there was a study started, which was the Framingham study, which goes on today. They were looking at a whole population and saying what appears to be the things that are associated with heart disease. And two or three things emerged: blood pressure, being a man, which is still the case. I can't remember exactly what it proved, but it definitely showed that a raised cholesterol was associated with a higher risk of heart disease in that population at that time. And so, it became the thing. Although interestingly, you know, during the 60s and early 70s, there were many drugs developed that were capable of lowering cholesterol, fibrates and cofibrate things, niacin, etc., which reduced the cholesterol level and increased the rate of heart disease and overall death. So by about the late 70s, in fact, the idea that you should be lowering cholesterol had almost been given up, and people were saying this is nonsense, it doesn't work. It was really the advent of the statins in the mid-late 1980s, where you had a drug that lowered cholesterol and it reduced the risk of heart disease at the same time, or cardiovascular disease, that people said, aha, this is it, we proved it. Any other thinking is wrong. It's all to do with cholesterol, lower cholesterol, and you're better. And really, there was a huge pressure then to get into all of this. So it didn't really take off until, effectively for the public and most doctors, it wasn't really taking off until probably the mid-90s, although everyone seems to think it's been around forever.
Another question is always, if after World War II, men were falling like flies here in the United States and it was not cholesterol, what was causing their death?
Well, I have my own views. Other people have their views. I think that one of the things that was causing their death was at the end of the Second World War, in America, 87% of men smoked. And there was no doubt that smoking is bad and causes heart disease. In Britain, it was the same thing. I mean, the cigarettes, smoking was seen as the healthy option for fit young men. Just amazing, really.
So the truth was hidden in plain sight, because I don't know if you know this, but in the 1950s, we had all these, you know, the advent of TV and so on. Doctors and commercials would be smoking, saying, I recommend Marlboro, Winston, or what have you. So the truth was hidden in plain sight. So if the doctor's smoking, that cannot be the culprit causing the deaths that we're seeing, correct?
Well, no, I mean, there were other factors involved. I think one of my own areas of interest is looking at what I would call, you're delving into difficult terminology, but I call psychosocial stress. That's my term. It's not just my term, it's been used by many other people. Basically, if you look at countries that have undergone major upheavals, and that doesn't necessarily mean war, because America was much less affected by war than most of Europe, obviously, after the Second World War. However, if you look at countries, I like to use an example, is Finland, because in the 1960s, Finland had the highest rate of heart disease in the known world.
Finland?
Yes. And you might think, why Finland? Why, it's a nice little country up there somewhere in Europe. Just for those who don't know, it's next to Russia, and between Russia and Sweden. So it's probably pretty chilly most of the time. But anyway, that was the country with the highest rate of heart disease in the whole world in the 1960s, such that the Finns were, they just didn't know what to do. So they carried out a few experiments and tried to do interventions and things like this. But what most people don't know is that after the Second World War, the Russians pushed about 700,000 Finns out of Russia in an area called Karelia, back into Finland, because they said, this is our land and you're not living here. And so they booted them out. So the greatest forced migration of peoples proportionately that has ever happened in history happened to Finland. And that includes what's going on in places like Syria today. And fairly rapidly after that, the rate of heart disease in Finland went through the roof.
Stress.
And it was particularly high in the region of Karelia and North Karelia. My belief is that when you uproot people. You shove them out of their where they've lived and where they've grown up, and you move them forcibly into different areas where they become alien, if you like, where they don't have social structures, they don't have social support. When you look around, the populations that this happens there. So in America, obviously during the 20s, 30s, you had millions of people emigrating from Europe to America. Millions. Then you had the Great Depression. Then you had the Second World War. So you had three of the most major gigantic stressors on an entire nation that it is possible to imagine. And the rate of heart disease went through the roof. And if you look at countries such as Australia, where after the Second World War, many, many people, very large population went to Australia, almost forcibly removed from parts of Europe and Britain. The rate of heart disease there went through the roof. Now it's falling. And people say in Scotland the rate of heart disease was very high. Well, this is true in the 1970s. But what most people don't take into account is that the largest city in Scotland is Glasgow, which had about 1.5 million people in it in the late 1950s. But they were living in tenements, what they used to call the gorbals, which were, you know, 10 people in a room kind of places. And they decided they would move out all these people out of these horrible, nasty tenements into new, wonderful new towns. So they shifted about 600,000 to 700,000 people out of Glasgow into alien communities around them. And at the point that happened, the rate of heart disease went through the roof. So I believe that you can see this quite clearly, which is why I'm very confident that the rate of heart disease in China is going to start going through the roof, because they've got an enormous sort of internal migration and social upheaval and social stress going on at the moment. And you can see this in India. The rate of heart disease in India is going through the roof because they're undergoing enormous social upheaval. So, yes, I think there's more to it than just smoking, but smoking played an important part. And also, I think there was an awful lot of really nasty chemicals around at one point. You can measure lead in petrol and nasty things in petrol and other chemicals.
Well, especially after the World War II, when all those chemicals were being stored in, aluminum and you know, depleted uranium after different wars.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, our environment was full of really nasty things as industrialization really kicked off after the Second World War. A lot of this stuff has been cleaned up. But I think there's an element there as well, which is quite important, which most people don't tend to look at very closely. It's because of interest to me that noticing that chelation therapy, which was a trial set up to prove that it didn't work, actually worked, which surprised me as well. And that's using EDTA, which is basically, I'm not quite sure exactly what the chemical structure is, but that kind of binds to heavy metals and allows the body to excrete them. And those treatments have been quite effective at reducing the risk of heart disease, for example.
So chronic stress is what you're attributing all of this anxiety, depression, caused by, and smoking is a byproduct of that stress.
Well, it's partly there, yes, I think so. Although I think smoking is independently. So when you say, I believe everything is wrong? I say, no, smoking is bad for you. End all. And there's no evidence I can see that it isn't bad for you. Exercise is good for you. I don't think you have to turn into a gym bunny and go down 40 minutes and burn every time you go down. I think walking in the countryside with your family and friends is brilliant exercise. But our body needs to move, and if they don't move, they start to degenerate, and they degenerate in all sorts of different ways. So I think that's important as well.
And then we have high blood pressure. Right? And it used to be, 160... over 110, and now it's 140 over 90, or even lower, depending on which guidelines you read. And I'm not a doctor or a statistician, but common sense tells me, Dr. Malcolm, that they're continuously tightening the boundaries. They keep moving the goalposts, aren't they?
I call it ratchet world, because
right,
everything ratchets, nothing loosens eventually. It amused me. I went through the American Heart Association, ACC, ladies' guidelines on heart disease when it came out, which were the most mad ones, I thought. I did the, you can have a calculator you can put on your computer, and you can put in your risk factors and decide what your risk of dying of heart disease is in the next, or having a heart coronary event, cardiovascular event, sorry, in the next 10 or 5 years. So I started putting in blood pressure on my figures, if you like, and then lowering it down. And at 150, it was a little better than 160. At 140, it was better than 150, et cetera, et cetera. And it kept getting better. And this was systolic, because they only seem to use systolic on that one. It got better till I reached a blood pressure of 90. So what they're saying is a systolic of 90 is healthier than a systolic of 100, which interested me because a systolic of 90 is considered to be hypotension. In other words, dangerously low blood pressure. So we have a state now where if your blood pressure is 91, you're at higher risk of dying than if it's 90. And if your blood pressure is at 89, it's at a higher risk of dying than if it's at 90. It certainly doesn't leave a long or a large sort of area for people to believe that their risk is completely perfect. You've got a 1.5 millimeters of mercury sort of safe zone, which is so completely ridiculous. It just made me laugh. But the reason why that model exists is because it's a mathematical construct. I don't know if if you get a graph and you draw dots on it so that, you know, an XY graph, and you have dots going along one line and going up. So as X gets bigger, Y gets bigger. Well, you won't see, the dots will never be absolutely in a straight line. They never are. They're kind of scattered. So when they did the blood pressure stuff, the dots were scattered. So somebody came along and said, oh, well, we may have these scattered dots, but what we can do is mathematically create a smooth line that goes, you know, top left to bottom right or top right to bottom left. This is a mathematically constructed line. It's called a log linear model. It was created from the Framingham data. Every time anyone's reviewed it, they've said it doesn't work. It's nonsense. And it's just a mathematical construct. And it doesn't exist in real life. And yet, it is the model that is used. It was created by a guy called Stamler. And he says that the relationship of cardiovascular disease to blood pressure is linear, continuous, and strong. And there is no threshold. And this is just nonsense. But it's a nonsense that all cardiologists and all doctors seem to believe. And it's just ridiculous.
The more I learn, the more I realize that what you're telling me, for example, that the area where it should be normal, it's all virtually almost non-existent.
Yes.
So it's either
non-existent. Yeah.
It's hypo or hyper and nothing in the middle, which means that if you fall into any of those categories, you are a candidate for medication, for low pressure or high pressure or high blood pressure medication.
Well, there's hardly any agents around to raise your blood pressure. There are one or two. But there's an awful lot of agents around to lower your blood pressure, and they are the most commonly prescribed medications in the history of probably the entire universe, I'd imagine. I think it'd be hard to find anywhere else in the universe where they went so mad as they've gone here.
But what is normal blood pressure then?
I don't know for sure, but I tend to, and although I can't tell my patients this because I work in a health service that follows guidelines and blah, 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 what I say to them is, I'm not worried about your systolic particularly unless it gets above 160, because there is a cut point somewhere. But of course, you have to ask yourself the question, and I've always asked myself this question, is why would the body just raise the blood pressure? I mean, at the moment, we call raised blood pressure, we call it essential hypertension, which sounds very posh, but essential means of no known cause. Hyper means high, and tension is just to do with your blood pressure. So if you put essential hypertension into English, it translates as raised blood pressure of no known cause. And that would be the raised blood pressure for 95% of people. In some cases, you can find an absolute cause for it. You might have a narrowed artery leading to your kidney, for instance. Now, that reduces the blood supply to the kidney. The kidney says to itself, I'm not getting enough blood. I need to raise the blood pressure.
Right. It
releases various hormones to raise the blood pressure. Now, if you open up that gap in the artery, the blood pressure drops to normal. There are there's diseases like Kohn's disease where there's too much aldosterone produced, and you can have other diseases where the blood pressure raises, but these are uncommonly rare. If someone has a high blood pressure and you send them off for test after test, what you'll come back with eventually is essential hypertension. And it's always seemed completely bonkers to me that the body would just suddenly say, you know what, my blood pressure is not particularly high, I'm going to raise it. I'm going to raise it to the point where it's going to actually cause me damage. How likely does it seem that the body is going to do this? Well, the answer is, of course, it's extremely unlikely. The body doesn't just go wrong. There is always a reason or an explanation for it, but we seem to have given up even bothering to find out what the explanation is. And we just say, well, let's force it down. So there's many different ways of forcing it down. And some of which are actually damaging. For instance, I'm not going to go into the pharmacology of how the drugs work. But there are things called alpha blockers, and I don't know what they're called in the States, because I can't remember the generic and brand name differences. But alpha blockers, were used in a clinical study where it was found that they lowered the blood pressure by more than any of the other blood pressure lowering agents, but they increased the risk of dying of heart disease and strokes. So they kind of knocked those ones on the head. And then they found that there's things called ACE inhibitors, angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitors, which are quite good, but and they actually do reduce the rate of heart disease and stroke. But interestingly, ACE inhibitors also increase nitric oxide synthesis in your blood vessels, a kind of what they call a pleiotropic effect. And I my own personal view is that the increase in nitric oxide is what makes them work. It's got nothing to do with the blood pressure lowering. And in fact, a number of people have looked at the studies over the years and said there's no relationship by the amount that you lower the blood pressure and the amount of benefit. But some medications that we use have got benefits, but that's totally unrelated to the amount they lower the blood pressure. So we have a whole series of drugs that work through different mechanisms, and we've decided that the ones that work by lowering the blood pressure. But if you decide to analyze the data, you know, what I would call accurately, the evidence isn't there. It doesn't exist. I mean, having a high blood pressure is associated with a higher risk of heart disease and strokes. That's true. But as someone said, having yellow fingers is associated with dying of lung cancer.
Right.
Does that mean if we scrub our fingers clean of yellowness, then our lung cancer will be cured? No. It means if you smoke, your fingers are yellow and you're more likely to get lung cancer. So we have high blood pressure, which we don't know what the cause of it is, which is associated with a higher rate of heart disease. But we don't know if there's something else that's causing both the heart disease and the raised blood pressure. Is there a yellow? Are we just looking at yellow fingers when we're looking at high blood pressure? Well, I think to a very large degree we are, because interestingly, if you go to the risk calculator for the ASCVD, I think it's called in the States, American College of Cardiology, and you put in that you've got high blood pressure, your risk is X. If you put in that you're being treated for high blood pressure, your risk goes up even more. So actually, being treated. Blood pressure, being on medication for high-range blood pressure is more of a risk for future cardiovascular events than having a high blood pressure. Go figure.
We had a famous television journalist over here in the U.S. who's doctors. His name was Tim Russert. You may have heard him on your side of the pond. His doctors recommended cholesterol-lowering medication as a preventive measure, even though he had normal cholesterol and had no heart problems at all. And a short time after, in June of 2008, he died of a heart attack. And I know you've written a lot about cholesterol. I hate to put it this way, but again, is this multi-billion dollar industry a scam?
Well, as you probably gathered by now, I kind of don't like to be utterly black and white about things.
Because I know, and I know the reason, I think.
Because things aren't black and white. But you say it's a scam. I call it a conspiracy. People say, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. And I say, yeah, well, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. And I say it's a conspiracy here of the willing, I think, in that patients want to be protected. They want to take things that are going to protect them. That's an understandable human desire. You know, oh, I'm frightened I might die of something. Well, if I take this, I'm less likely to die. Doctors like to do things for patients that they feel are protecting them. It makes them feel good because that's their job. Pharmaceutical companies are quite happy to go along with this, obviously, and provide things that they say will protect people. Then you have governments who say, look, we are protecting our people. Aren't we wonderful? So you have a kind of quadrilateral here of everybody wanting to believe it. Everybody wanting to feel protected. Everybody wants to have this. And then there's vast, vast sums of money to be made. The people that I blame in the midst of all this are really the people who should be protecting us, which are the opinion leaders, the experts, because they are not stupid. Some of them may or may not believe in this stuff. I've spoken to enough of them who've looked at the floor when I've confronted them sufficiently that it's clear to me that they know what they're saying is bonk. But they just, it's very, very difficult because at the moment in the UK, we've just had there's a group called the National Obesity Forum who've come out saying that, you know, we should all be eating more fat and less carbohydrate and that will stop us getting diabetes and it'll help on weight loss. And then all of the establishment figures have come out in a kind of howl of outrage because this is the accepted meme, if you like. And once that happens, it's incredibly difficult to change it. So is it a scam? Is it a conspiracy? It's kind of everything. It's the worst thing of all. It's a belief structure because belief structures are the hardest things to get at, you know, to really prize open, and change. And people really do believe that cholesterol, I mean, if you went out, if I go out to that, I know this, if I go out in the streets or speak to friends or whatever, and I say, I don't think cholesterol causes heart disease, they look at me as though I am literally mad.
Oh, sure.
How could you possibly believe that? I mean, I've given up really arguing with them because it seems impossible to argue with them because they just close their mind off immediately. And I just say, I sometimes say, well, what is this, the one single piece of information, the one study, the one thing that has most convinced you that cholesterol causes heart disease? And they can never give me an answer. It seems that belief structures like this just become reinforced by, well, he said it and he said it and he said it and he said it. Sometimes people come back and say, well, familial hypercholesterolemia, what about that then? Because people with really who have very high cholesterol levels are more likely to die of heart disease. And almost like, nya, 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 that's it, argument proved. To which I have to say to them, well, actually, if you look at the information, that's not actually true. The very interesting study was done by the European Atherosclerosis Research Society. Yes, such a thing exists. Now, the problem that you have in medicine, and I've always find this a very difficult one to sort of outline, especially when I haven't got a graph and things to point at. So I'll try and do it verbally. If somebody comes into hospital and they're about 35 or 45 and they're quite young and they've had a heart attack, and then the doctors say, ah, your cholesterol level's 8.3 or whatever, which would be about, say, 400. That must be due to your cholesterol. And of course, that just is what they call confirmation bias. Yes, you're 45. Yes, you've got a cholesterol level of 350 or 400. Well, it was the cholesterol that did it. That's definitely true. And then what they've done is they've gone around and looked at their relatives and they've looked around and said, oh, well, you've got familial hypercholesterolemia in your family and there's a high rate of heart disease in your family. Case proven. To which I have to say is, yes, but you've got an enormous bias in the study here because you're looking at people who are genetically related and you're finding that one of them's got a high cholesterol level and quite a lot of them will obviously there will be a high cholesterol level in all of them because it's genetic. And there's a high rate of heart disease in this family. Now, this of course proves nothing because it could be another factor, a bit like yellow fingers thing, that is causing them to have a high cholesterol level or that might be nothing to do with it. But it might be something else that's causing them to die of heart disease because remember, they're all related. So they will share many, many other things. So picking on one thing and saying that's it is, it might be correct, but it might not be. So what they did, this group, they said, right, well, we're going to remove that bias. What we're going to do is we're going to go and they asked a bunch of university students, asked about 200,000 university students in Holland and the Netherlands. And they said, did your father or, well, first degree relative, as they died of heart disease, prematurely, younger than the age of 55, which is the definition of premature heart disease, what is at the moment. And then they said, for those who said yes, they then measured their cholesterol level, right? And so you would expect that in amongst the group, and they had a matched group where there wasn't heart disease, premature heart disease. So you would think that you would find more people with familial hypercholesterolemia in the group where there was premature heart disease in their family, found randomly, not through an association that may exist in other ways. And they found that the rate of familial hypercholesterolemia in those young people at university who had a first degree relative with heart disease was about 1 in 500. And in the control group, the rate was 1 in 500. And that's about the same rate as familial hypercholesterolemia, about 1 in 500. So there was no association whatsoever between familial hypercholesterolemia and dying young of heart disease in this study. Now, the most interesting thing about this study, well, I thought the finding was quite interesting, was that this study was never published anywhere ever. And to which you might say, well, how do I know about it? Well, I found out about it, and I spoke to the person who ran the study and asked them why it was never published, and they said, oh, we didn't think it would be of any interest.
Really?
Yes.
I remember about 18 years ago when I got married, I went to get a life insurance policy for, you know, mental safety, if you will. And I remember when my insurance agent called that he had received the blood tests and so on, saying, well, you know, we're going to have to double the policy. I mean, double the amount that you pay over the premium. And I said, why? Well, because it looks like cholesterol is too high. It's almost like you ate 10 cows yesterday. And I just couldn't understand it because I felt great. So anyway, I didn't want to take statins. I started taking red yeast rice. But a few months later, I, you know, went to the gym. I realized that my muscles were getting weaker. I was losing muscle mass and so on. And I stopped. And I realized that statins, I spoke with a pharmaceutical sales rep who wrote a book about all of this, Confessions of an RX Drug Pusher. And she told me, yes, statins and all these drugs, they weaken muscles. What is the heart? A muscle. What are the kidneys? A muscle. So obviously, it's not working as they predicted it would.
Well, no. Well, I mean, red yeast rice is a statin. Effectively, it's the same thing. So it will have the same side effects. People say to me, oh, I take red yeast rice. I look at them and go, fine, so you're taking a statin then.
Right.
Because that's where it came from. That's where it was discovered. Red yeast rice produce statins to kill off animals and insects that try and eat it. So it's a natural killing agent. And then it was discovered and it lowered cholesterol. And then from then on, of course, everything moved forward. But yes, statins, I mean, the party line and the line that I still approach is, well, in some people, statins may provide more benefits than harm. Increasingly, I've reached the point of saying, you know what, they don't. You know, frankly, all the evidence we have come from pharmaceutical sponsored clinical studies. And the more I look at pharmaceutical sponsored clinical studies, the more I think, you know what? I'm not quite sure I believe it. I don't want to reach the point where I think that a theoretically, you know, well-controlled clinical trial is biased to the point of unbelievable. But an interesting fact about statins is that there was a point where if you started a clinical study, you didn't need to tell anyone you started it. And so you just ran it. And if it produced positive results, you published it. And if it didn't, you buried it. And this was kind of discovered, you may go back to the SSRI thing, you know, the antidepressants, where eventually an American court, I think the Supreme Court, I'm not sure if it was the Supreme Court or not, but anyway, they demanded that the pharmaceutical companies produced all the clinical trials that had ever been done on antidepressants. And before they did this, there were, I can't remember the exact details, but there were 27 positive studies and no negative studies. When they were forced to produce all the studies, there were 27 negative positive studies and 26 negative studies. In other words, they don't work. Well, they didn't work in these studies. So I think somebody then said, you know what, really, if someone's going to run a clinical study, they ought to tell us they're doing it. So at least they have to produce the blooming data at the end of it so that we have at least got more chance of seeing negative studies as well as positive studies. So in around about the early noughties, 2004, I think this really came in fully. For the pharmaceutical industry, it came in earlier for the National Institutes of Health. Some very interesting work's been done on this. But essentially, since 2004, there has not been a single positive statin trial.
And look, there's definitely, correct me if I'm wrong, I think definitely there's a crisis, at least in the United States, of obesity. Just go out to your local retail store and you will see what I'm talking about. And at least in the United States. But are they also moving the goalposts for obesity and diabetes? And I hear there are people who, with a body mass index or BMI lower than Brad Pitt or George Clooney, who are defined as being obese?
Overweight, I think. Yeah, their body mass indexes are at 27 and 28, I believe. Although, you know, being as they are film stars, they might be fiddling the data somewhat. But
right.
I mean, a lot of athletes, you don't play, they don't play much rugby in the United States, but rugby being a bit like American football, the guys, some of the guys that play are built like, in Britain, we call them brick shit houses.
Right? Like walls. Yeah.
Yes. And they're big guys, and the forwards, which would be a bit like your, line of scrimmage people, is that what they call them?
Right.
These are big guys. They're fit, they're strong. I mean, some of them are maybe a bit overweight, but they all got BMIs well over 30. So as a measurement, that's bonkers. But equally, every study that I've seen, I can quote you, the data is very strong, shows that people who are overweight, and overweight is defined as having a body mass index between 25 and 30, people who are overweight live the longest. They live longer than people of, in brackets, normal weight. So why do we call people of normal weight normal weight? Why don't we call them slightly underweight? And why don't we call people who are currently overweight normal weight? And in fact, when it comes to the whole obesity thing, we have a BMI of 30, which is, I presume it's the same in America, but it is kilograms over meters squared. So I don't think you use kilograms over meters squared or anything like that, but these are strange European measurements. But it doesn't work very well if you use feet, inches, and pounds, because it's a much more complicated calculation. They used to have a thing called the ponderosity index prior to the BMI, by the way, which we won't go into. But anyway, 30 is, so if you were, a BMI of 30, you don't have to be gigantically overweight, but that was defined as being obese. And I wondered at one point, well, why, who decided this was the figure? This was the, where did this come from? Because one of the things I found by looking into medical research over the years is you think someone says something like five portions of fruit and vegetable, then you go and try and find the evidence and you find it doesn't exist. And people look at you as though, well, it must exist. Somebody must have done the study. And I go, okay, then find it. But with BMI, I thought, well, who decided a body mass index of 30 is the definition of obesity? Because I'm always very wary of round figures. You know, why is it 30? You know, 3-0. Why isn't it
27.3 or something, yeah.
Exactly, because if it was a true figure, it seems remarkable that nature has designed obesity to exactly match a measurement system that is equivalent to 1/1,000,000th of the distance from the equator to the North Pole over the exact weight of a liter of water squared divided by whatever. Anyway, but it's 25 and it's 30 and it's 35. You'll notice in America, of course, high cholesterol is over 200 milligrams per deciliter. In Europe, that's 5.2, but in Europe, a normal cholesterol is 5. So there's a big gap there, just because it seems normal. Anyway, I found out the World Health Organization had a meeting, and they produced a 600-page document about this meeting, which I read. I don't quite know how I managed it, because it was boring beyond boring. And I found eventually that they decided that the definition of a BMI of 30 equals obesity was largely arbitrary. Their words, that was all they had to say on the matter, which I think was quite interesting in a 650-page document. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So we are now in the middle of a largely arbitrary epidemic, and no one can define what obesity is because it's mad. And if you go into it in more detail, you find that a body mass index, what they tend to do is they say, well, body mass index is, I'm not sure if it's exactly the same in the States. I think it is pretty similar. I think it's 18 to 25 is normal, below, or 20 to 25 is normal. 25 to 30 is overweight. Above 30 is obese. But of course, that means you're categorizing people with a body mass index of 31 as being the same as somebody with a body mass index of 60. And you're clumping them all into that group. Now, there's no doubt that once you reach over 40 in your body mass that you are starting to increase your risks. But if you look at other studies where they've split obesity into type, you know, stage one and stage two, so people who have a body mass index between 30 and 35 tend to have about the same or slightly lower more overall mortality than people who have a normal, in brackets, weight. So, you know, once again, we have this thing where people just define figures and groupings, and you can't make sense of them.
I'm glad you're discussing this, because I have the chart right here, page 121 of your book. And when I saw that chart, I almost fell off my chair, because, you know, I'm between normal and overweight. But when I saw that overweight, the chart basically, folks, just to have a mental picture, it's mortality rate versus the BMI. If you're underweight, that means from 8 to 18.5, you have the highest mortality rate, even more than being obese. And then, right, then you have normal that goes, you know, to 1, and then overweight has 0.80 probability. Then it goes up to obese, and then, you know, stage 2 obese. But overweight as the lowest probability of mortality, that really took me by surprise. I guess I'm happy now.
Yes, a lot of people are happy. I mean, there's a lot of explanations for this. And of course, there's like the explanation of the experts in obesity is, well, that's rubbish and it's not true. But you know what? You can find those charts everywhere. That's not just one study. That's every study. And they'll just go, well, we can't explain this. Therefore, it must not be true. The other explanation in part, which may be true, is that if you carry a bit of extra weight, that if you run into a health problem, like get a bad pneumonia or something, or something
energy
bad,
reserves,
then you have energy reserves to get through it. Now, there's no evidence that that's true, but it seems a reasonable hypothesis to me, is that as an animal, you know, I would say, you know, no one goes up to a polar bear at the beginning of winter and shouts, oh, you fatso. Even though they might be carrying 400, 500 pounds of added fat. You know why they're carrying that fat? Because they've got to survive for 6 months.
Hibernation, right.
And they build it up. Now, the question is, are we hibernating animals, or are we not? I think there's an element of large animals, such as us. Probably it's quite a good thing to build a bit of extra weight, because, you know, stuff might happen to you. And you don't want to be right on the edge of having no fat reserves. And because you won't have any energy, you'll start breaking down muscle and you'll start damaging your kidneys and whatsoever. So I think, nature has probably designed us to be a little bit, carrying a bit of extra fat. I don't know how much is optimum. And you can argue about that inside out and upside down, but, the evidence is very clear. You don't want to be skinny if you want to live a longer time.
Well, I've asked Native Americans around the United States, especially here in Arizona, where we have very, very cruel summers with, you know, very, very high temperatures. But I've spoken to some of them, and they have told me that in the old days, they would eat a lot of fat in the winter, getting closer to the winter, so they could save a lot of that energy, because in the summers when they would have to go out there and do the harvest and get all that, and they would lose weight in the summer. So even the ancient cultures are aware of this.
Yeah, well, I think it makes sense, doesn't it? I sometimes used to, I don't know again if it's true, but there's no doubt that fructose seems to be most obesogenic, causes you to become fatter than any
fat
other substance.
Switch.
And you find that in fruit mainly. Well, naturally you find it in fruit. And, fruit comes out in the fall, or autumn as we call it over here. And people eat fruit in the autumn. And maybe that is a design feature. It's designed to make us put on and store fat, because we get hold of it at that time of year, just before the winter comes in. Add 20 kilos to our body mass or whatever it is. And that helps us get through the winter. Now, I don't have any evidence that that's true, but it kind of makes sense.
It makes sense, because what I've found so far is that sugar is the fat switch. It turns on, you know, makes you save the calories. But the part about the underweight people, because you see a lot of people trying to lose weight all the time, thinking that that's what's going to make them the healthiest. I want to start showing them this chart.
Yeah, well, there's an element of obviously fashion involved in this as well, because people like to look thin, because other people say, oh, well, you're just fantastic, look how thin you are. You're not going to change that immediately, I don't think, are you? But so it's, you know, the driver is not entirely health, is it? It's also fashionable to look thin.
And look, many people talk about doing things in moderation, but some may argue that, you know, I smoke in moderation, but isn't this still bad for your health? But here's another one we hear all the time, doctor, that you know, please correct me if I'm wrong about the statistics. How much fear do we literally have to inject in people and tell them all the time to stay out of the sun? And isn't it true that the countries with the highest amount of sunscreen use are the ones with the highest incidence of skin cancer? What is Australia and New Zealand? You have a high concentration of fair-skinned people close to the equator, but using a lot of sunscreen. Is there a correlation between sunscreen usage and skin cancer?
Well, the answer is yes. The short answer is yes, but of course you might say, well, you've got another factor here because people who put on a lot of sunscreen tend to live near the equator, so they're getting more sun exposure, and that's what's causing their skin cancer. Very difficult to disentangle these things at times, but I think it's very clear that if you just screen one form of, if you just screen the UVB, is it UV? I might tell me if I'm getting this the wrong way around. The UVA will still get through, and right. The UVA may be the thing that causes cancer. So it's a bit like the argument of wearing dark sunglasses outside to protect your eyes. But if you wear sunglasses to protect your eyes, so long as they are actually of a reasonable quality, that's fine. But if you wear sunglasses, your pupils dilate, more sun gets, more of the damaging rays get in, and you actually cause more damage to your eyes.
Interesting.
So you have to be very careful that you don't damage your eyes by thinking you're protecting them. Again, with sunscreen, are you damaging or protecting your skin? Now, I tend to use, and I've told my children to use, expensive sunscreen that, because burning is horrible, so you don't want to burn, to put that on to protect both UVB and UVA. Now, a lot of sunscreen didn't used to protect against UVA, I think that's the right way around. And therefore, they were spending more time in the sun and getting, actually, that was the thing that was causing the damage. Now, there's a contrary argument to that as well, but that seems to me to be correct. Also, I think some of the earlier sunscreens were basically horrible chemicals reacted with the sun and caused carcinogenic things to be released into your skin, which I think was definitely the case. Whether that's still the case or not, I'm not entirely sure.
I know in the United States, I still see it all the time. Propylene glycol, there's antifreeze, alcohol also. But isn't sunscreen, in essence, turning off the alarm that our body has given us? In other words, I plaster myself with sunscreen. I go out in the sun at noon, and I don't feel the burning because it's protecting me, but I'm not getting burned. But the UVA rays are still getting through, aren't they?
Well, that seems a good argument. I mean, I always say to people, I never manage it myself, but I would say, what you want to do is get out of the sun earlier on in the year, although where I live, that means about now, and start building up your tan gradually. So you don't burn, but you get a nice sun exposure. You build up a tan, your skin's, that's how it's supposed to be. You know, I work on the basis, one of my touchstones is, how did people used to live? What did they used to do? Well, they definitely didn't have sunscreen. They didn't stay inside all day. When it was sunny, they were outside. So they were building up a tan gradually. And that was what they did. And I think that getting as close to that approach is where you should be. I mean, there is, you know, the issue of staying in a house, being completely protected from the sun, and then suddenly going on holiday to a beach and lying out there for 2 weeks. It's probably not what you're supposed to do. Because I don't think your body sort of deals with that very well. And there is some evidence intermittent sun exposure like that is more damaging than gradually building up your tan. Of course, the counter argument to that is that, well, maybe what's happening is that people are actually, it's a lack of sunshine altogether that's causing skin cancer, because in the United Kingdom, the two groups of people who have the least malignant melanoma, that's obviously only one form of skin cancer, but it's the one you don't want to get. The two groups of people who have the least malignant melanoma rate are farm workers and builders who spend time outside getting a tan. So they have the greatest sun exposure and the least risk of malignant melanoma. So I think there's some quite good evidence that proper sun exposure protects against malignant melanoma.
This is all very important. Now we have to take a one and only break. And as you said, how did people used to live? That's one of the questions I always have. And I also want to know why people who are super centenarians are able to do so today with so much stuff in the air, in the water, in the food, and they still live to be over 110 in many places and blue zones around the world. But we'll discuss a lot of this when we come back and more. How can people buy both of your books, Dr. Malcolm?
Well, definitely on Amazon, where they are available. I think that's probably the easiest place to get them, I would have thought. Not just Amazon, other internet providers are available, I think, although I'm not entirely sure if you can get the books on them.
I love the way in which
I'm not a very good salesman, am I?
Go ahead.
So I'm not a very good salesman.
That's okay. I think the books sell on their own, especially because you have injected a lot of humor. The way in which you write makes me smile, but also it makes those details that you include really sink in. Two books, The Great Cholesterol Con, The Truth About What Really Causes Heart Disease and How to Avoid It, and the newest one, the one we're discussing tonight, Doctoring Data, How to Sort Out Medical Advice from Medical Nonsense. And to sort more about all this medical advice and medical nonsense, when we come back with Dr. Malcolm Kendrick. This is Mel Fabregas, and you're listening to Sanitas. Don't go anywhere. Thank you for listening to the first segment of this very important Sanitas interview. If you enjoyed it and wish to listen to the rest, go to sanitasradio.com, click on Members or Subscribe, or tell someone else who will enjoy this and all our radio programs. If you are listening on YouTube, like, subscribe, and share it. Don't forget to visit the Sanitas store, where you can purchase pure organic sulfur, earthing and grounding products, supplements, a USB drive with all our shows, gift certificates, rebounders, and much more. Now, join me in the Sanitas member section to enjoy the rest. Thank you.